Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Hey folks, while we experience this technical difficulty, let's talk about the Metropolis Kittens Hospital. They need donations. Used cat boxes, little bits of string, a patch of ripped up carpet. All donations are welcome and appreciated.
Kumbaya, I have all that stuff. I can help those little kittens. It never hurts to help.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody, and welcome to another Talking Simpsons interview. I am Bob Mackey, hoping for no whammies. Who is here with me today?
Henry Gilbert, and it never hurts to help.
Exactly, and today we are talking to the great Bill Kopp, an animation legend. And if you existed throughout the 80s, 90s, and hell, even today, you've seen definitely at least a few of the things he's worked on, right, Henry? Including the initial Tracy Ullman Simpsons shorts.
Yeah, that was, I had reached out to Bill Kopp a while ago after we did the David Silverman interview, you know, hearing about Bill Kopp, that I had seen his other works like Eek the Cat, Terrible Thunder Lizards, the Pressure Luck Whammies. But I wasn't aware that he was like the third man of the original Simpsons animators with David Silverman and Wes Archer. And so we wanted to seek him out and chat with him on a podcast. And he shared with us so many interesting details about those early days of animating The Simpsons on Tracy Ullman.
Yeah, we talked to him about his entire career, both The Simpsons stuff and also working on the Roger Rabbit shorts, working on Eek the Cat, working on the finale for Tales from the Crypt, and so much. He basically tells us on the podcast he has not been unemployed since he left CalArts. And we talk about CalArts too.
Yeah.
Because he's in the CalArts mafia.
He was part of that group of folks who would leave CalArts in the early 80s and change the animation industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. And he has so many interesting stories about his time there. And yes, he is the voice of Eek the Cat. And if you love Eek the Cat, you will hear him do voices.
So just close your eyes. Imagine us talking to a purple cat.
The friendliest purple cat in the world. Yeah, it was so cool talking to Bill. Definitely check out his website for a lot of his content there. BillKoppAnimation.com. Definitely check that out. Sadly, he's not on Twitter. The fool. He should be on Twitter, miserable like the rest of us. So I guess without further ado, give a listen to our interview with Bill Kopp about all of his work, including the earliest days on The Simpsons. Bill, thanks so much for coming on. I guess I wanted to start first with asking, you know, you got your start at CalArts, I believe, which, you know, a lot of folks who'd go on to change the animation industry like you were starting then. Like, what were there any other memorable alums you were with then?
Oh, my God. Everybody. Gary Trousdale, Rob Minkoff, Kelly Asbury, Chris Sanders, Peter Chung. I know I'm forgetting some, but it was the whole... Joe Ramft was there. John Lasseter was a couple of years ahead. Tim Burton, of course, went there. Mm. He was gone by the time I got there. But yeah, it was great. Savage, of course.
Yeah, it was. What was the feeling then at CalArts? Like the early 80s isn't known as the brightest period in American animation. So what was the feeling?
That didn't come until later. It was... I was a painter when I first went there, but I became quick friends with all the animation guys, and then I switched my major into animation because the animators were just way more fun than the brooding painters. You know? So So my second year, I was officially in the animation program and did Mr. Gloom and Observational Hazard, and those both won the Student Academy Awards.
Yeah, no, those look so great. You can see so much of your skill in those. You know, you see some folks as, you know, student stuff, and you're like, oh, I can see the a little bit of what they've come to be. But like, there's so much like great experimentation in those ones for sure.
Yeah, well, that was the experiment. There was character animation, which was where most of my buddies were, but the experimental animation program was where I was assigned to, or whatever you want to call it. And we were really just trying to do weird stuff. I mean, there was a lot of drawing. A lot of drawing went into those films.
So how did you come to start working with Savage Steve Holland, especially with his first two feature films?
Well, Savage was, I met at Cal Arts. He was a couple of years ahead of me, one or two years ahead. I can't remember. But I was 18. I was too young to buy beer. And Savage was like the hall manager of the dormitory that I was in. And of course, you know, he likes beer. So we became quick friends, and we just were always really friendly and funny together. And that's how that started. Yeah. He was my first mentor, really, I think. You know, he taught me really how to write fast, and he was just a really funny guy.
And yeah, in those early days, like, what were some of your first jobs? I know there was a game show I definitely am interested in, but was there a thing, anything before
that? Well, that came later.
Okay.
My first job was Better Off Dead.
Oh, okay. I
was still finishing my second film. That came right after I graduated, and I still was finishing up my senior film. And then as soon as that was done, like in September, then that October of 84, I went right to work with Savage. And then right after that, we did One Crazy Summer. And then after that, The Simpsons.
Man, yeah.
I think I first got to know your work because it existed as a cartoon in a place where a cartoon usually wouldn't be, like especially One Crazy Summer. I was captivated when that came on HBO just from the crazy, insane intro with the hyper-violent cartoon.
Oh, it was hilarious, wasn't it? Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that was what was cool about it, you know? It was throwing something in there that was really like a sideways thing you're not expecting.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of satire is carried on. My Tales from the Crypt is like that. It looks like a really goofy cartoon, but then it just goes horribly wrong.
Yeah.
It's fun to do that with, I mean, it's a cartoon. It's fun to get super violent.
What I mean, and violent cartoons like were really not happening in TV. I mean, there wasn't, like, if it was theatrical animation, then it was probably just Disney, and like that was in shambles in the early 80s.
Yeah. And then a lot of guys that graduated before me, you know, were going off and they come back to visit or whatever, and they'd be like, I'm working on this thing called He-Man, and I want to pull my head. And I was looking at those drawings, and like, I would not be able to draw that. I don't know how to draw that way. I can't draw that way. I've been really lucky because my drawings are like really mutated, but I've somehow managed to make a living off of it.
Yeah, in those live action films, like when I saw One Crazy Summer the first time, like just the Rhino short, it freaked me out, but I also loved it as a kid. Yeah. I'd never seen anything like that. I didn't know cartoons could do that.
Well, we were animating really hard too. Like most of that animation is all shot on single frame, so that's why it's very, very smooth. You know, we were young animators, so we really wanted to do the hardest thing you could do. It's like, yeah. Animate really smoothly. Thousands of drawings.
So was it on One Crazy Summer that you first worked with David Silverman? And is that how you worked on the initial Simpsons shorts?
Well, I met David Silverman because I had a film called Mr. Gloom. My junior CalArts film won a Focus Award. And at the same year, too, that's when I met Catherine Hardwick, because she won also. And Silverman had won the year before. And we all met each other there. So, and, you know, we became fast friends. And then David was obviously a great animator. And then when Crazy Summer started up, I was just like, dude, you got to get in on this. And then we went on to The Simpsons.
We've chatted with Silverman before. He had mentioned that on One Crazy Summer that there would have been more animation, but something got cut from it too.
Oh, there was a lot more. Yeah.
Was it just a budget thing?
I saved everything. I've still got all the pencil drawings.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. There was a couple other big sequences that never got finished.
Ah, that's too bad.
Or they got finished, but some of them didn't. They all got shot in pencil tests, and some of them got to the cell color point. And then a lot of them, they just cut it for time, you know.
Was it an accident that Steve Holland got into live action, or did he wanted to?
Oh, no. He was doing that at CalArts. He was doing both animation and shooting live action. Plus, Savage is very charismatic and very funny. And, you know, he's a lot of confidence. So he had written Better Off Dead already while he was still at CalArts.
It is funny. We were just watching some of the earlier shorts before this interview, and we can see, like, that is a Bill Kopp drawing. That is a David Silverman wild take.
That is
a Wes Archer famous twister mouth on a character in those shorts.
Right?
So.
I'm the really crude one. David's the guy that really can draw, and Wes is the freak, you know.
Well,
but we had so much fun doing that, but we were locked up in that room for like 2 years, just the three of us. And Matt would come in like once a week, once or twice a week, and we'd work stuff out. But and then when it really got cooking, of course, David was the one that really had an affinity for it. And he's the guy that really took it into the series and honed the style and pulled it together. He loved it. And thank God for the world that he did.
And what did you think of Matt Groening's, writing and ideas for these shorts? Because they really are, these early ones, very much paced like a three or four panel comic strip.
Yeah, they were very much like that. Well, we were big fans of Life in Hell. That was it in the Reader or the LA Weekly? I forget. So we were already fans of his. And then Wes was the one that got together with Gabor Chupo and got the gig. I mean, I remember getting the phone call from Wes saying, like, hey, because we'd all shot out of CalArts and we had never been out of work. And here it was 1986, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, that's right. We have to look for a job. And Wes called me and got me started. And he and I were the first two guys there. And they were just like, this is too much fucking work. We need another guy. And I was like, let's get Silverman in here. And that was that. And then I think we brought Tim Bjorklund in down the road. But it was about 2 years of, we lived at that studio. But, you know, we were in our mid-20s or whatever back then. So we didn't give a shit. We didn't have anything else to do but screw around and animate.
Well, yeah. What was the, the Klasky Chupo offices were pretty new at that time, right? So
it was down on Seward and Melrose and in this really old part of Hollywood. And we used to call it Film Town. And it was where all these old editing places were. And it was like, they were all populated by these really crusty old men, you know, who were like smoking while there's nitrate film around. They're just like, fuck it, kid. I did a bunch of shorts for Fox, right? I think before The Simpsons started. And I would go down there all the time to edit. So we'd rent these little editing rooms and you just have it was like being on a fishing boat. You know, you'd have this crusty old guy like, you don't know shit, kid. Here, let me show you how you do this. You know? And he'd be editing for you and they all smoked. And they really did. They looked like pirates, man. But that whole part of the town was just all little film hovels that had existed probably since the 30s.
Man. Well, we've heard before too that like it was super fast like turnaround for the animation you had to do on that. Like what?
Yeah, every week it was a minute and a half of animation. So we would split it up into threes. So each of us would have 30 seconds to animate. And actually, when it first started, there was another sequence too that they cut. It was a MK Brown underground comic artist lady. And, that. Dr. Nagatu, and that got dropped. And then, that was like, you know, because we're still animating like crazy people. So our stuff was, even though it looks so crude, it was like animated really well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So 30 seconds in a week is a lot for one person.
Yeah, we noticed they're so much fun to watch just because a character will kind of look different in every scene, but they move so fluidly and there are so many fun things they can't do on the TV series. Was there any sense of a character being on or off model, or was it just like, we have to get this finished? They can look like what they kind of vaguely look like and Matt Groening's general idea of these characters.
Well, I'm sure you've seen Matt's early drawings.
Oh, yeah.
Matt can barely draw, let's be honest. Okay.
He
and then when it comes
it.
To animation, you know, then we have to like try to pull together. But we're trying to retain his vibe because we loved. That's a joke. I mean, he just draws the way he draws. You know?
Yeah.
But it's about it was about the writing. You know, that was good story stuff for us too because it was fun to watch. You know, we're already liked him, so it was fun to sort of see how stories evolved and characters came to be. But no, we never worried about being on model because there really weren't. I mean, it was crazy, and until the later part of those shorts, and then when it went to the into its first season, that's when Silverman pulled it together and said, "Okay, look, you know." But yeah, it was great, you know. But no, we never worried about it. We just wanted it to be funny. We wanted to animate funny, you know.
I was curious, like, how much your biggest impact on them, like, character design wise, because definitely, like, Marge changes and Bart changes a lot. I think most of all, like, yeah.
Well, Marge's hair, and I'm on record for this. That was me. Marge's tall blue hair, because the original drawings of Marge, she just had this short hair, you know, thing. And all my, like, older relatives, older lady relatives, were, like, the blue, classic blue hairs. Mm-hmm. And they all had, like, big, like, beehive-type hair. And that's where that came from. I was like, let's make it blue and make it big.
And
that should be in your IMDb bio, inventor of Marge's hair.
You know, my IMDb, I don't know who wrote them. It's all messed up. And I just was talking to my agent the other day, and she's like, you got to fix that. Like, I don't know. I don't have time for that. But yeah, I should. Yeah. But so you can't rely on IMDb or Wikipedia for that matter. They get everything wrong.
I was also curious about in the first run of episodes, there's an infamous scene that got cut after the first airing of Maggie putting a fork in a light socket. I was curious if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Bit.
I think I animated that one.
Okay.
She gets electrocuted big time.
The take does look like one of yours, I'd say.
Yeah. But she goes all fracky and lightning bolt.
Yeah,
that's fine. Yeah.
Did you know they got cut after the first airing?
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, Fox, there were concerns about kids imitating
it. I'm sure, yeah. Broadcast standards and practices, yeah.
And did you
have that's kind of cool to know. No, somebody pulled that out and put it's on YouTube. Somebody made a collection of my Simpsons stuff, and it is in there. So you can still find that somewhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't buy those shorts commercially. They've never been made available. How do you feel about that? I feel like it's an important part of Simpsons history.
You know, here's the thing about being the Simpsons. Like, I loved it, and it was great, but I was still, like, really young, and I wanted to learn more about animation and the animation process. And right as the Simpsons went into going into series, I got an offer from Disney to go and work on the Roger Rabbit shorts, and I couldn't turn that down. Mm-hmm. So I left to go do that. And I'm glad I did, because I learned a lot. But no, so I don't have any. I love The Simpsons, but I got to be honest, like, I haven't watched probably 80% of them. No other reason. I just don't, you know, it's like, I don't know. I have no ill feelings, but I get shit all the time. People are like, oh, you left before the thing. It's like, dude, I was like 26 or whatever, you know, I was still learning, you know, and an offer from Disney to get into certain with other CalArts guys that I loved, you know. So, of course, I went for that, you know.
Yeah, to be part of that movement, just the animation renaissance that was happening there. And Roger Rabbit was sort of leading the charge.
Oh, yeah. I remember the day that movie opened. We all went to the Cinerama Dome. Every animator in town was there. Man, that kitchen scene just blew everybody away. And it's funny, too, because I remember I think we were going back to work after that. And I said to the guys, I was like, man, wouldn't it be awesome if they made shorts like that? And then like 2 weeks later, I get a phone call.
Wow.
Like, we're making Roger Rabbit shorts, you know.
Well, did you get a feel? I definitely want to talk about Roger Rabbit, but when you were at Simpsons in those late days, did you get a feel like it was starting to get popular, or did it feel just like a weird little thing? Okay.
Oh, yeah. We definitely knew that people liked it, but you know, no one could have predicted the success that it would have had. I mean, that'd be like going to see the Beatles play in Hamburg and going like, wow, these guys are great. You know, but not having any idea that I would, you know, take over the world. But we knew it was popular. Yeah, we did. I was also like, I really was still, like I said, I was learning. I wanted to learn more. I'd been working kind of on other people's stuff for a while. And the Disney experience was still, I'm working on something else, but it was in a different level, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got to really get into story there. And that's where I really learned how to write. And if I hadn't done that, we wouldn't have Eek the Cat or Mad Jack the Pirate or Toonsylvania or any of those other things, because I never would have taken the time to sit down and learn how to write.
So we know most of the public story of what happened with Roger Rabbit. How much of that did you work on? We just know, like, Disney had invested so much into that character. It's why Toontown was built in Disneyland, but because of the Eisner-Spielberg dust-up, that project essentially just kind of fell apart because he wouldn't approve anything. That's what the public knows on the outside. Do you have any insight into that at all?
Well, we got to the point where I think we had one really funny one that was called Beach Blanket Bunny that never got off the rails. And after the trail mix-up one, like we, Pat Ventura and me and, here's my brain not working. Anyway, so they kind of said, we're putting the Roger Rabbit stuff on hold until we figure it out. And they said, we want to make Mickey Donald Goofy shorts. We were like, great, bring it on. And they're like, here's the scripts. And we were like, scripts? What is that? We never wrote. We did story, but we never wrote. We always drew everything. And we read these scripts and they were terrible and clearly not written by anyone that knew anything about animation. And I don't know who wrote them and I don't care. But they were awful. And I got into a big argument with my boss at the time. And I said, I can't do this. I can't work on this stuff. You know? I left after that I went on to Tasmania. It took a while, but remember the question. Did I answer that?
Yeah.
So the idea.
There was also a feature script kicking around with the Roger thing. And that never came to be either. And I don't know why. I mean, I don't really remember the story. I'm sure it had great stuff in it, but
After
the shorts, I mean, it just kind of all phased out. I think that Jeffrey might have been leaving around there too or something. It was getting a little goofy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think so. What you're saying is the plan was to transition from Roger Rabbit shorts to Mickey, Donald, and Goofy shorts then? Was that their idea?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it seems like that never happened.
We would have been great. We would have loved to do that. Well, I think the guys that do the Mickey Mouse show now have kind of filled that. I mean, that's the kind of thing we would have ended up doing, you know. But I love that show. I love those shorts. I think they're great.
Oh, they're amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think they got out of that one Runaway Brain one, but even that was like too extreme for Disney.
Well, you can't really do that with Mickey, can you? Mm. You know, like that. They were also doing a lot of weird merchandising stuff, like a lot of tacky things happened back then. You know, they also had me and Pat Ventura working on the Toontown thing. We did a lot of work on that for gags. We worked with Wed a lot.
On
coming up with stuff. And we had a whole Goofy's bus tour thing, like what really the ride devolved into. But there were some tacky things that were happening too, like where they do like Mickey with the hat and he's like posing like, you know, it's just like, what, you know, weird stuff.
Well, yeah, I remember Tummy Trouble and Roller Coaster Rabbit. They were both just amazing looking, like the animation quality level, like it, you guys had such a high bar with the, you know, the Oscar winning animation that was in the film. Did you guys,
well, it had to at least get there, if not top it. So I think it's the last time people were doing like hand painted watercolor background.
Wow. And how involved was Steven Spielberg, like hands on with those shorts? Because
everywhere. He was great. You know, I remember pitching him, especially on Roller Coaster, and I'd have a weak gag and I'd kind of try to skip through it, you know, and I'd get to the end and he'd be like, okay, but what about this over here? And he'd go right back to that weak spot. He was great. He was super nice. I worked with him a couple times after that too. He was great.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And on Toonsylvania, right? That was one of the first DreamWorks shows.
But it was Steven there too. Yeah.
The Roger Rabbit thing, I remember those, like they felt just like classic cartoons. Like that was what was so special about it. Like, cause as Roger Rabbit, like introduced, you know, me and Bob's generation to the classics in a way we weren't really seeing on the He-Man shows and all that. So, I mean,
well, we were looking back at guys like Bob Clampett and, you know, early Tex Avery. Psychedelic animation. You know, our theory was like, and I still live by this, it's like if you grab them by the eyeballs, their brain will follow shortly thereafter. So it was about being visually stunning enough where like, this is so fun to look at. Then the rest of the cartoon can take you, you know, wherever we decide to take you.
So in the 90s, you had quite a good run on Fox Kids with the Eek the Cat series, which Henry and I both grew up watching and love. Can you talk about like the pitching process of that and what was it was like to work under Fox Kids? It seems like you can get away with a lot on that cartoon.
Well, after all the Simpsons Roger Rabbit stuff settled down, I went to Tasmania. They wanted me to direct on that, but I wanted to write because that's what I was doing. And then I hooked back up with Savage and we started kicking around, you know, this idea because he had done some work for Fox and he had sort of an in there and he was like, let's, you know, he had this cat. So we just kind of started messing around with that character. The idea of this really sympathetic, positive guy who just gets the shit kicked out of him, a basic cartoon axiom. And, you know, I think we did storyboard and we had it animated up in Vancouver and I can't remember the guy's name, but he did, it was like a minute or maybe a little less. And so we took that into Fox to show Margaret Lesh and then I guess we made her laugh because she bought it.
That early time Fox Kids was kind of finding themselves, like it's definitely before they got Batman and the X-Men, all the action stuff. Like, yeah.
Well, they kind of had that before Eek. They had Tiny Toons and they didn't have Animaniacs yet. And I think Batman was sort of, when we sold Eek, I left Tasmania. And I think Batman was just getting started or had maybe just started. But Margaret Lesh was the key person, you know. We just made her laugh, and she trusted us, and she would just let us go do our thing. That's why the show worked, because they just left us alone. Oh, boy, I wish more executives were like that.
No, I hear you.
Yeah.
They don't realize how much trouble they cause just by trying to do the right thing, supposedly. And really what they're doing is wrecking the opportunity for great fun. There's a big trick to doing it.
And you're also the voice of Eek, and that's all I can think of when I'm talking to you now on this call.
That's right. Absolutely, I was.
This is not the era in which creators voiced their creation. I mean, there was John Christofalusi on Ren and Stimpy, but that would come much later. How did you end up being the voice of the character that you created?
All right, well, this is going to sound insane, but when I was a kid growing up, I had a cat named Chauncey. And when he talked to you, because all our animals spoke in my family, everybody did the voices of the animals,
right?
So he'd call you a sapsucker and he'd ask for, you know, something to eat. So he had this list and that's the way he talked. So whenever we were messing with Eek the Cat, you know, I would just do that voice in the meetings. We'd say, yeah, like this. And we tried to get real actors, you know, to do it, but nobody would listen. It was just came down to like, we're recording next week and you're doing it. So
it's such the perfect voice for this, you know, forever put upon helpful guy who's just destroyed. Yeah. Though the show had amazing voice talent too. Like, I mean, just Gary Owens alone, like, was just so good.
There's so many people in there. I mean, I can't even. God, I wish that I had taken more pictures, you know. But I never wanted to be that guy. Like, hey, you know. But man, we had William Shatner, Mr. T. Guys from X-Files, Buck Henry, Tim Curry. I mean, it just went on and on. People just loved it, you know, so we could get anybody we wanted, really.
And, yeah, I mean, were there any, like, you know, censor issues on the show? Because it was...
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
It was half of our job. There's a really funny article. I think I have a copy of it somewhere. It was from, like, Entertainment Weekly or something like that. And it was the list from Broadcast Standards and Practices about the certain gags that we couldn't do. And we gave it to them and they published it. And it was hilarious. Cause it's just like, please don't give the postman a machine gun. Can you use an axe? Yeah. But I mean, yeah, we were always fighting Broadcast Standards and Practices because mostly I get why they're there, but they're mostly full of shit. And it really doesn't matter.
So, like, eventually, in the run of Eek the Cat, it became a vehicle for other characters and shorts. When did that idea come about? Of course, talking about Terrible Thunder Lizards and Clutter as well.
Yeah, Clutter was later. The Thunder Lizards came, I think the Thunder Lizards came, like, on top of the second season. And then I went, I think after the second season or maybe right towards the end of it, then I went to Disney to do Snookums and Meat. Went back to Disney.
Yeah.
I was still doing And Savage and I would still work on stories together, but you know, I it was that Snookers and Meat, the offer for that show was the first time I had my own show, you know. And that's really what, like, I'd been working for all these other people, so it was time to dig in and do something on my own.
Yeah, unfortunately, that show is a bit lost. It's not on Disney Plus. And I find it an interesting outlier from the traditional Disney afternoon style.
It's really funny. I mean, the cat and the dog part of it are probably the weakest part. Tex Tinstar and Piff Possum, I mean, the animation is incredible. And the stories are really funny. Yeah, it was a great experience.
Was Terrible Thunder Lizards originally planned as like a full Eek spinoff, and or was it always going to be a second short with it?
I think Savage just wanted to expand the universe of the whole thing a little bit, and it was a funny idea, and we just said, well, we're just going to make it part of that show. It was a way to try to, you know, expand the franchise, I guess you'd call it.
And man, Charlie Adler is so good at that too. His pain is just perfect.
He's so good. I have so much respect for that guy, and I still talk to him periodically. He's great. He's one of those guys. I think he was in every single cartoon show I ever made.
Yeah, I think so. So I have one more Eek question I really want to get into. Is my favorite episode as a kid was the Melvis episode, Great Balls of Fire.
Oh, man. Daddy-O.
Yeah,
we're going to win that race.
See, that was a joke that made me hysterical as a kid, because just the repetition of that, of every Elvis movie, was so, so funny.
I love Elvis because I just love tacky, hey man, daddy-o. I just love that voice. I love doing it. I love Elvis. And it's just so funny to say, like, I don't want to be a guy sweeping up the basketball court, Lou Elson or whatever he calls her. You know, I want to be an astronaut. It was, oh, Melvis. You know, the girl is like, oh, Melvis.
Oh, God. Yeah, I love that episode. I mean, too, that, like, you know, in 92 or it was still going around the, like, Elvis Lives kind of stuff. So.
Oh, yeah. That was, there was a big show Bill Bixby hosted about Elvis still alive, maybe. Oh, yeah. We were all over that.
There were still Elvis sightings reported.
Yeah. And I that story is great, you know. I mean, I did him again in Mad Jack. There's an episode where they meet this guy, the Great Kapow. And it's like Elvis, but he's like the Wizard of Oz. He's hiding. And he's this god, and they keep the island's made of food, and it's called the Great Kapow. If you like my Melvis, you gotta watch that one.
That's just my total favorite there. I did, you know, to backtrack a little bit, I did want to ask about the Pressure Luck Whammies, because those. Yeah. I didn't like watching most as a little kid. I didn't really care about game shows,
but
those, just waiting to see a whammy do a thing. I love that.
And that was way, way, way before digital drawing was a thing. So that was a machine called the Quantel Paint Box. And it was this really crude device that's why the whammies looked like shit, because there was no way to really animate on this thing. And Savage had been doing that as a freelance thing. I think it goes back. So, you know, everybody pins it on me, but it was really Savage. And then he gave it to me kind of in between movies. He's like, here, do the whammy. And then it stuck, you know. but I can't believe how I still get, you know, emails from people that, you know, it's like, I'll give you $50 if you draw a whammy.
Yeah.
I know there's been a reboot of Press Your Luck, but I don't know if they kept the whammies. I was too afraid to check, because they'd be like CGI whammies now, I bet.
I remember, too, when they were doing that, I actually got called into a meeting with whoever was doing it. And they were like, yeah, we're going to do it like CG or whatever, you know. And I was like, great. That's better than what we did. I didn't want anything to do with it.
As a kid, it was just a treat to see anything drawn on television, just to see a cartoon.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like looking for a prize in a cereal box or something like that. It's just an oddball thing. And they weren't funny. It was so dumb. It's like, you never know what people are going to like. I mean, you know, so the worst thing you could draw ends up, you know, being like something that people love. It's just weird. I mean, you can work so hard and wants one thing and nobody gets it, and then just like throw something off, and then it's like, ah. But I think you're right. I think it was the culture at the time and the audience, you know, were just like, it was just so weird. It was unique.
Yeah, something you've never seen before.
Yeah, especially in afternoons on cable before, you know, cartoons were on every cable channel. It was there's no cartoons on, but I can watch this game show and I will occasionally get a cartoon.
3% cartoon content.
Yeah. And then there was that guy that figured out the board, remember?
He made a whole documentary
on that guy.
Another thing I did want to ask about was the Tales from the Crypt episode, the third pig. Like, it's the final episode of the original HBO of Tales from the Crypt. Like, so how did that come together to do a whole animated episode of Tales from the Crypt?
Well, for years, and I mean years, like maybe like a decade, I'd been trying to pitch the Tales from the Crypt, or what, I don't, this story called Little Dead Riding Hood. I finally did a book last year of it. Mm. And I got in with somebody at Joel Silver's company, like, I don't know, right? Maybe during the Eek thing, or maybe it was Tasmania, but I would call the office, his office, every day at like noon. And his secretary just got sick of me, you know. Finally, she set up a meeting, and still it didn't really go anywhere. And then years, I guess, into the early 90s, because that was 94, I think. I finally got a meeting and I pitched it to Joel Silver, and Nelvana had helped set this up because of all the Eek stuff.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, good. Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I like it. And then like the next day I get a phone call from his, not from him, but from his office saying like, Joel wants to know if you got a Three Little Pigs one instead. And I'm like, yeah, I got it right here. I did not have. And I wrote that script in 5 days. I just like sat down and wrote it. And then I took it in and pitched it, and he was like, great, let's go. It took about 6 years, you know, for me to get in there so I could finally get an episode.
No, it starts as a like kind of a parody of the Disney Three Little Pigs, and then it grows from there. I especially loved like how, I mean, you definitely take advantage of being on HBO.
Yeah.
With
the well, that was the gag. It's like, you know, we're not doing classy animation here. It's gonna look like Rocky and Bullwinkle, but it's gonna be so, you know, if we'd have done like One Crazy Summer style animation or Roger Rabbit on that with the blood, it would not have the same joke impact. Mm. The reason the violence in Tales in that third pig works is because it's drawn so expressively crude that it works. And if it were done with like glory, the joke would not have been. It's the same like in Holy Grail and Python with the Black Knight. Mm. It has to be that absurd.
It's some of the most disturbing screaming I've heard Cam Clark do in something, I think.
Yes.
He was great in that.
I especially love it ends with a blackout gag, but then the wolf pulls it open like, no, you're gonna watch me eat this pig, like it's gonna happen.
Well, you still don't really see him eat. I mean, well, you kind of do, but it still goes, it just, and then there's blood. And it made me say pork the other light meat, because the white meat phrase was copyrighted.
That's lame. Gee, man, we could ask a million more.
You
things.
Do see him eat him, actually, now that I remember, right? He bites his head off.
Yes. Yeah. You see his insides. It's intense. And
I think you see everybody's insides.
Yeah.
I say put it on HBO Max.
Yeah. What the?
Did it?
I think the Tales of the Crypt, it's not on there
yet. It's not yet.
It's like none of it.
It's on Prime. You can find it.
But yeah.
It's also on YouTube. I mean, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But Bill, is there anything you want to talk about you've been working on lately that you'd like people to check out?
Well, I did my Little Dead Riding Hood book, which I'm really proud of. And there's only like 100 copies of that. There's a couple on eBay and there's some on my site. I am right now getting involved in a new show, but I can't talk about it yet. But it's really cool and it's pretty big. I think it'll be soon, because things are starting to progress is moving ahead.
That's good.
It's a new show. It's a show that everybody's gonna like.
All right.
There's a little bit of familiarity to one of the characters, so.
Okay.
I really can't say. Yeah, I'm under orders.
All right.
There will be something said probably in a few weeks.
Oh, okay.
Oh, cool. I'm looking forward to it then. You just recently, I think, did a voice on that the series Amphibia, I believe. Are you doing more voice?
Yeah, I played a frog. Yeah. On that. Yeah. Also, I want to say on this new show, I'm also working with Kyle Carroza. He's I've made him supervising director on the thing that we're on the secret thing that we're doing. And then I did some voice work on his Magiswords thing. Fishman.
Awesome. Wow. All right, man. I mean, I can't
Which
wait to hear what this
Pierre
is.
Which is Pierre from Eat the Cat.
I love Pierre. I love him.
Because I'm French.
Man. Oh, but thank you so much, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
We are looking forward to
it. Hey, you're welcome. These are good questions. Sometimes I don't get as good a question.
And my girlfriend Annabelle.
Well, gee, she's really fat.
Really?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.